Hello and welcome to the Mother Earth News Online Homesteading Summit. This is Marjorie Wildcraft, your host. Now, have you ever wondered what a selfie is in the seed-saving world? And no, it does not involve a cell phone. This is actually a time when you can deal with selfies and not be embarrassed. We have got a presenter for you. Bill McDorman is the executive director of the Rocky Mountain Seed Alliance. He got his start in the bioregional seed movement when in college in 1979, where he helped start Garden City Seeds in Missoula, Montana. Bill also started the Seeds High Trust Altitude Gardens, which was a mail-order seed company that he ran successfully until he sold it to an intern in 2012. He's authored the book Basic Seed Saving, which is an excellent book I might recommend, and he and his wife Belle Starr have created a seed school. This is a nationally recognized week-long training that has graduated over 800 students from around the world. You know, Bill is such a good presenter. I actually would love to attend his seed school sometime. He's really one of the best presenters I've seen on explaining, seeds and how why you want to connect them and inspiring you. And I especially love some of the myths he talks about hybrid varieties and why mistakes are actually really beneficial to you. Let me let you watch. This is going to be Bill McDorman with Save Your Selfies.
Hello, everyone. This is Bill McDorman, and I'm here to help share some of my excitement about seeds. I really think that seeds are the most powerful and important thing you can ever hold in your hand. And when you buy seeds, as most gardeners and farmers do these days, you're passing up the opportunity to take advantage of the most important and powerful thing a seed represents, and that's adaptation. On more than 300 generations, over 10,000 years, have been successful in building what we call civilization because people simply stopped and saved seeds from the things that they were eating, planted them, and selected to save the seeds from the things that were a little bit better and planted them again. It's a ritual that is awe-inspiring to me. And I just want to save it. And so I've spent about the last 30 years trying to figure out how to get more people involved in this. And this is my best attempt so far. What I've essentially done is found the vegetables and the grains that are easiest for us all to get started around this incredible ritual so that it doesn't have to be complicated or scary and that we can have success right from the beginning. So I got started in this whole adventure in 1979 when I was trying to find the best seeds for my own garden in Missoula, Montana, when I had bought a little house and I was on my way back to college. With friends, we ended up starting Garden City Seeds because we found enough of the older adapted varieties that had been around for generations in Western Montana that had essentially disappeared from any kind of commercial distribution. And we wanted to share them. And so our little seed company was part of a nonprofit to educate people that not only were there seeds available that had been adapted to Western Montana, that had been brought there by the immigrants, but they were available again and that they could save their own seeds from the ones we were selling them and actually keep this process going of adapting and readapting and making better the food crops that we had there in Montana. In 1984, I moved back to Ketchum, Idaho, where I grew up at 6,000 feet, and I started another little seed company called High Altitude Gardens. It was the same idea. Every valley, every region, everywhere should have its own source of seeds, seeds that are adapted to that place. This is what we had a couple of generations ago, so it wasn't a new, scary, or radical idea. It was just, in a way, getting back to what we had had. I ran High Altitude Gardens, which became Seeds Trust High Altitude Gardens when I incorporated a few years later. And I did that for 28 years, clear up until 2011. In that year, my wife, Belle Starr, and I were recruited to be the executive directors of Native Seed Search, the great seed conservation organization in Tucson, Arizona. We did that for 3 years. and now we're the executive directors of the Rocky Mountain Seed Alliance based in Ketchum. Probably the most important thing that we've done was start Seed School, what we call Seed School, in 2010. This came about with the realization that I had that I had, in a sense, become the person I'd been looking for way back in 1979 when we tried to start a small regional seed company. There was nobody there to teach us. There was no roadmap. We really didn't know how. There were a few other companies getting started at the time around the country around the same realization that we needed to conserve and save the genetic diversity that was left in our communities and make it available again. But we really didn't know how to do it. Well, 25 years later, I realized I did know how to do it. And I had earned that through making hundreds, if not thousands, of mistakes on the way. And so I thought if I could share some of what I've learned with others, then that would help the whole process. And I really believed that it was an exciting and incredible opportunity for people to get back involved with seed saving. Our local food movement was just getting started, was burgeoning, and yet nobody was talking about local seeds. Well, I'm happy to report that now we've trained more than 800 students, or we have graduates from our seed schools, our 6-day, 1-day, and online programs. Those students have gone on to start hundreds of seed libraries and seed exchanges around the United States. And maybe I'm most proud of the fact that 17 of our students. And I just want to emphasize just how exciting and extensive the movement is right now for people to go back and save their own seeds and share them with their own community so that we can all have access to adapted material that does not come from somewhere else. More than 500 seed libraries have been formed. These are people that have signed up at seedlibraries.net. More than 400 in the United States alone. This is Dr. Gary Nabin, who helped start Native Seed Search in Tucson, Arizona, is now head of the Center for Regional Food Studies at the University of Arizona. And he's checking some seeds out there at the Pima County Seed Library, part of the Pima County Library System in Southern Arizona. And they now have 9 branches of their seed library and their 23 library system. And they're actually hooked up with interlibrary loans. So you can go in, look at everything that's available, that's been checked in by other people with their stories and what they're adapted to and what they're good for, and have those seeds delivered to your branch of the Pima County Library anywhere in the system. And that's an incredible thing that's happened. Also, seed exchanges are popping up everywhere. If you haven't been to one, start one. This is really the best beginning step for anybody who's grown and saved any of their own seeds to get some of the other things that other people are saving in their area. It's also a great place. You know, imagine you move to a new town like Tucson or like Ketchum, Idaho, that has a little bit different climate, and you're looking for seeds. You know, what most of us do now is get out the catalogs in January, February, and we look through them and we get all excited, but we're bringing in seeds that have nothing to do with adaptation to that climate, or very seldom do we. Whereas if you had a local seed exchange, you could go down to that seed exchange or seed library and not only get seeds that were adapted to that area, but also get the tricks and the stories it would take to be successful gardening in a new area in your first year. I just can't emphasize enough how important this is. This has become an institution in Canada. Seedy Saturdays have sprung up all over in almost every city and town, and many of them now have more than one. And this is just the way people are beginning to get their own seeds as part of a national movement there to become self-reliant, to make Canada self-reliant in its own seed production. If you get excited enough about this whole process, you can actually even start your own seed bank. This is a really great example of something that's happened in the last 10 or 12 years in Greece. Politi is a living seed bank. What that means is that once a year they have a big festival. It's music and food festival. And everybody that's stewarding seeds that are important to this network, brings them back, and they sit down with databases, they figure out what's working, what isn't, who has what, and then they pass out the seeds that they need to other people, and they all go back home and grow and save those seeds. And so this grassroots association is now taking care of more accessions, as we call it in the seed bank world, more different kinds of varieties of seeds than the Greek National Seed Bank. And this is the future, I believe. We have community seed banks springing up all over the United States now, the upper left and the world. The upper left picture there is Navdanya. That's a picture of Vandana Shiva's great network. They now have 121 seed banks that they've started in the last decade. Community seed banks. These are places farmers can come and get their seeds. And if and when they can, they return twice as much. And in this way, they're building a tremendous community resource. The lower left picture there is Florida Mayo. She's one of the 13 sacred indigenous grandmothers. She lives in Estancia, New Mexico. She had a dream that she had to save the seeds. And that's Greg Shane next to her, a really great plant breeder. And together they put together their seed temple, they call it. It's a place to store seeds and to really honor the spirit that's in the seeds. The picture on the right there is Emigdio Bayon's seed bank in Tezuque, Pueblo in New Mexico. Another example of a community realizing just how important seeds are to their whole, not just their whole gardening and farming system, but to their way of life and knowing who they are. And amateur plant breeding was the only kind of plant breeding there was. In this age where we think that big universities and multi-million dollar corporations are the only ones that can create the new varieties we need to feed 9 billion people, we have to remember that almost all of the food that we have now was produced by us, amateurs, in small scale, in our own backyards and small farms, without even knowing who Gregor Mendel in genetics was. So here's what I'm going to cover for the rest of this to try to get you up and running around saving your own seeds. I'm going to find the easiest way for you to get into this. All right. So first, I'm going to talk a little bit about what's keeping us from doing this, because there's a lot of myths out there. I'll talk about what a selfer is, a self-pollinating plant. I'll talk, give you specific instructions about 9 important selfers. And I think you'll be surprised that they're some of our most important and popular things we grow anyway, and they're the easiest to save seeds from. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about selection, because it is the most powerful breeding technique. And with these tools, you're going to be well on your way to helping us all return to this important, beautiful, and powerful ritual called seed saving. So maybe the best way to start this is to tell you a story, a true story that happened to me when I was the director at Native Seed Search. I had a master gardener come up to me and say, "Bill, we've got a real problem." And I said, "What's that?" And she said, "Well, I've been helping out the Pima County Seed Library." And I go, "Yeah, thank you for all your help answering gardening questions there. The Master Gardeners Program in Tucson partnered with the library to help answer gardening questions so they could answer the seed questions, or find people that could answer the seed questions and actually run a seed library." And I said, "So what's the problem?" And she said, "Well, people are starting to check seeds back into the library." And I said, "Well, that's what they're supposed to do. Isn't that what a seed library is? People check seeds out, and if and when they can, they grow them, save them, and check in twice as much. That's what we expect to happen for the library to grow." She said, "The problem is we don't know what they're checking in. We don't know if it's junk. We don't know if they've made mistakes. And so what are we going to do? We may be getting stuff in that, you know, it's just not good." And I said, "And?" In a way, I was taunting her a little, and I didn't really mean to, but why is that a problem? And she said, "Well, because we don't know what the germination standards are. We don't know if they've had minimum populations. We don't know if there's been cross-pollination." I said, whoa, what is this for? And that got me to thinking about a way to explain to her that it's okay for seed libraries to do this, that this is how diversity's always been created, is by amateurs and beginning seed savers making mistakes. And of course there's going to be mistakes checked into the library. And the important thing to remember is that these seeds that are being checked in are probably not going to be used for a commercial or industrial agriculture. If they were, she would be right. They would may not be good enough or uniform enough for a farmer or gardener to depend on them for their crops. But that's not what is happening with seed libraries. Backyard gardeners are taking them home. And what we found in seed libraries is if you really want good things, if your eye is on purity or making sure that it still has vitality because the population minimums have been kept, then do some research on the person that checked in those seeds. And it's quick. It's like eBay with people that have high ratings. Pretty soon, a seed library learns who is doing what you may call a better job. And if you want better seeds, those are the person that you get your seeds back from. So basically, all of this is based on a misunderstanding of the scale of agriculture and seed saving. So let me go through that just a little bit to help you understand, because I think this is really important. How did we get to the point where 10 food companies own and control almost all the food produced in the United States or processed and sold, and 3 seed companies own maybe 72% of the world's seeds? These are huge, gigantic companies that are bigger than countries. Well, we know that the larger you make an agricultural entity like a seed company or a farm, the more profitable it can be for its owners. It's just it takes the same amount of work to load the hoppers and get the tractor ready to plant 2 acres as it does 20, or maybe even 200. You just have to drive a little bit longer. And based on this scale, we've let farms get big. Most of us don't farm anymore. But something we learned at Earth Day in the 70s is that the smaller you make a farm, the more ecological and resilient it is. And so we're faced with this incredible choice here in the 21st century as citizens. We need food. There's no doubt about it. And we're seeing this burgeoning permaculture and urban farm movement that's growing on a much smaller scale that is more sustainable and resilient. However, will it produce or can it produce enough food for us? You know, every dollar we spend on foods, we should look at the scale at which that food was produced. And hopefully the dust will settle in a decade or so and we'll know what scale we need to support. Now, the corollary idea with seed saving is that the larger the agricultural operation, the more uniform and predictable the seeds need to be. If you're a farmer, you want your crop to be ready at the same time and look pretty much the same for market. Otherwise, you're going to have to cull out the things that aren't as good. This happens with wheat, with protein and starch contents. There's all sorts of ways that we have made our modern seed stocks for industrial agriculture incredibly predictable and uniform. But the corollary is that the smaller your agriculture or your entity growing food, the more diversity you can allow. In fact, gardeners love diversity, say, in harvest times. Instead of having all of your tomatoes or all your peppers ripe at once, and you could serve have a big party and serve them to everyone, say, the second or third week in August, and then you don't have anything else, it would be nice if some of them came early and some of them came late. You're not in there with machines trying to harvest it all at the same time and wasting money if you can't. So diversity is actually a plus for smaller entities. And so if you think about that then, the misunderstanding of scale that this master gardener had that walked into the library was this, that she was trying to apply seed saving rules for large scale or industrial agriculture to small farmers and home gardeners. And so the conclusion to all this is the smaller the scale your agriculture, the easier it is for you to save seeds. Clear down if you're growing one tomato plant and it's not, and you checked it out of the library and it's not quite what you wanted, you'll still get tomatoes. This Dr. Carol Deppe emphasizes this over and over. What's the worst mistake that can happen when you're playing with genetics and saving your own seeds in your own backyard? You still get something to eat. You're still gardening. And there is a chance that whatever happens in that mistake may be something that you like better. It becomes your variety. And that simple act is what created our modern agriculture in large part. It is a history of mistakes, unplanned, unpredictable things that happen genetically that we learn to take advantage of. So what we've really done is create a cult of expertise. All right, this is a quote from Sandor Katz, who wrote The Art of Fermentation. And he talks about this with fermentation. We think you need to be a doctor with a lab coat on in order to do ferments in your own kitchen. And in the same way, largely most gardeners think you got to have somebody professional. You have to buy your seeds in order for them to be good. And what this has translated into is the numerous seed saving books I see out there, the $25 and $30 seed saving books. And there's some beautiful ones and they all have great information. That's not what I'm upset about. What I'm upset about is that the beginnings of them, and these are just a couple of clips I took from two of the more popular ones, right in the beginning, they just look complicated. You know, to have your table of contents start in Latin for most beginning seeds, I don't want to learn Latin. I just want to save seeds. Or I don't want to learn all the structures of flowers in the beginning. I just want to save my tomato seeds. And so I think we need to take a little bit of a different approach, and that's what this webinar represents. So, you know, we all think seed saving is too difficult when we first come into it. I've given lectures for 39 years, and that's the overwhelming first thought is that, wow, I want to learn this, but I better batten down the hatches and get the equivalent of a master's degree in botany because I'm going to learn to save seeds, that it's way too difficult. But as I've showed you, if you're doing this in your own backyard, if you're doing this on a small scale, if you're doing this so that your livelihood doesn't depend on the uniformity of the crop, then it's easy. It doesn't have to be difficult. Seed saving's not worth my time. Every farmer at a farmer's market tells me this. They understand local food needs local seeds. They just don't have the time. They're all overworked. And I honor that. This whole system is stressed. On the other hand, how did we do it before? Two generations ago, everybody that grew anything save their own seeds. And I believe this can be integrated in and take little or more no time. It's just a change in the habit of how we do this. And it makes things so much better. It's worth the time. We don't think our seeds are going to be as good. Well, I don't know what I'm doing. They may not be as good. And this is not true either. So many of the packeted seeds we buy these days are actually have dead seed blended into them to bring them down to national germination standards. When you start saving your own seeds, you will see a vibrance and vitality and germination that you've never seen before. I hear this over and over. My seeds can be better. And of course, I might make a mistake. What happens if a bee flies over from my neighbor's that's growing pumpkins and gets into my zucchini flowers? Pumpzinis. I love pumpzinis. I just think they're incredible. And who knows, you may come up with one that's better than any zucchini or any pumpkin you've ever seen. And there's stories of squash like Waltham butternut winter squash that wasn't developed by a university or a multinational corporation. It was a mistake found in the backyard of a part-time insurance salesman in Pennsylvania in the late 50s. Again, when you open yourself up to seed saving in your own yard and the possibility of mistakes, you may be making things better, not worse. And this I hear over and over again, you can't save seeds from hybrids. If you're an industrial farmer and you save seeds from hybrids, what we call the F1 generation, the filial one generation, and you save the seeds at the F2 generation and plant them, you will get anything but the uniformity that you got in your original crop. All of the hidden recessives, as we say genetically, that were in the grandparents start to surface again. The way a red-haired child might show up in a family that had a black-haired father and a blonde-haired mother. Those red genes were in the grandparents somewhere, and they didn't show up in that first generation. They all looked relatively the same, but in the second one, wow, watch out. So if you're a farmer that depends on uniformity, you can't save seeds from hybrids. That's where this comes from, but it's, again, it's a misapplication of the scale. If you're a small backyard gardener, it's Mr. Toad's Wild Ride. You're going to get all sorts of new things to look at. And when you find the ones you like, the ones that look like the parents maybe, save the seeds from those and plant them. And that third generation will be even more like the ones you want. And the fourth and the fifth. And usually by eight generations, you can actually stabilize any hybrid and get what you want. So let's get into what a selfer is and why that even makes it easier. So we know it's easy to do small scale, but now we're going to make it even easier. So the first question, and this is we teach in our seed schools. The first question is you should ask when you want to save seeds from something new and you want to do it well, you want to improve it, understand what its breeding system is like. Ask, what is this plant's breeding system? And it turns out that there's a scale for one of the most important characteristics of the breeding system, and that's whether it self-pollinates or cross-pollinates. A self-pollinating plant has a what they call a perfect flower. It has both the male and female parts in it, and the male pollen pollinates the female portion of its own flower lots of times before the flower even opens. So this system does not depend on pollen from somewhere else. And this is what makes it so easy, because you can grow them in your own yard and be relatively assured that you're going to get what you planted. There'll always be differences. There'll be things that are a little bit better, come earlier, taste better, more drought tolerant or whatever. And that's what you want to select for. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. But still, you'll get mostly the same variety that you're looking for. All right. So there's a picture of a tomato flower. The sexual reproductive parts of that flower are in that cone that sticks out to the right. The stigma and style, the female portion, will actually poke its way up through that cone. But to get through it, it will rub the pollen off that's on the inside of that cone. The anthers are fused to the inside of that cone that produce the pollen, and it will pollinate itself. Now, sometimes there's leaf cutter bees. Sometimes they get blown or torn open. There's always a chance that there'll be different pollen in there. But most of the time, you're going to get what you plan on getting. And so that's why selfers are so important to us as beginning seed savers, because we can just grow and save seeds, and we don't have to worry about isolation, and we don't have to worry about population numbers by and large, and we can just save seeds from what we like. Wow, what a great thing. So let's just get into saving them. You know, tomatoes are the gateway drug to all gardening. And what a neat thing that they're a selfer. I mean, everybody everywhere should always save their own tomato seeds. Look at this. You can even eat the tomato and save the seeds. There's no better deal out there. And you might get, in that tomato in the lower left there, enough seeds from one tomato to last you for the rest of your life if you have a small garden. We're talking about a tremendously abundant system here. So cut it at the equator. Make sure that the stem is up and it looks like the North Pole, and then cut it at the equator, and that'll open up the cavities on the tomato. Squeeze out that jelly that has the seeds into jars. You can see them doing it here. If you only have one tomato you're doing, you want to put a little bit of liquid in with that jar so that it won't dry out over 2 to 5 days. Put this in a warm place out of the sun. I put mine right behind the sink, and I watch every day, and I'll stir it every day. By the third day or so, you should start to see the mold begin to form on the top of the jar. That is the sign that nature's doing its work, its magic. That's actually a bread mold on the top. And inside is a yeast that's eating the jelly away from the seeds so that they can settle to the bottom. They're clean seeds settling to the bottom, all right? What you want to do then is fill that jar up with water completely and pour out everything that is not seeds. Fill it up with water and let it settle for a minute so those seeds are on the bottom. You don't want to pour those out, but then pour everything out. And then fill it up again and pour it out. Fill it up again and pour out all the phlegmy stuff and the bad seeds. And you'll have something that looks like, in the lower left there, in the end, just clean water and seeds in the bottom. You want to strain this through a sieve. I just tip it over onto a screen or a sieve. If I've got one, all the water goes out, and then you take that and tip it upside down on a paper towel or a napkin. And voila, you have a little tomato cookie, I call it. It'll, in two or three days, this will dry out. You can rub those seeds apart in your hands. Make sure you label it. Make sure you label it with the date and the year. Sometimes you get these things stacked up and you'll want to know what year it was, especially if you had a great year one year. Second sulfur, peppers. Wow, how hard is this? Just rip it open and get the seeds out. You can do this with ripe peppers. But if you will wait until they completely dry out, if you can, if you've got a long enough season, or if you can pull the whole plant at the end of your season, say it's going to freeze or snow or something's going to get it, you can hang that plant upside down and let the peppers dry out completely till they're crinkly and dry, and then break them open and the seeds will just pour out. And if you do this, you'll get that golden pepper seed color. This is what professionals look for in pepper seed. This is Steve Peters from Revolution Now Seeds taught me that. And so this is what you're looking for. This is when you know you've got great pepper seeds. Okay, beans. Here's a picture of bean. You may want to eat them green as green beans, but if you'll just let them dry out, and there's a picture of the sequence until those pods are more of a rawhide color, a tan color, the beans will just start to fall out of some of them. Some of them you have to shake a bit. Here's, again, I pull bean vines and plants regularly when I lived in Ketchum, Idaho, because we always got a killer frost end of August, early September, and mine weren't quite ready. So I'd pull the whole plant, shake the dirt off the roots, bring it in, and let it finish drying before you try to get the seeds out. Threshing beans is the way to get the rest of the beans out of the pods. You can stamp on them, especially on soft ground like this. There are some beans hard enough to drive over in cars, and you read about that in the folklore, but we used to put on bluegrass music there at Native Seed Search and have bean threshing or bean stomping parties. Peas, same thing. These are all self-pollinating plants. The crop is the seed, so with beans and peas, you're not able to eat it and save the seeds the way you are with tomatoes and peppers. Nevertheless, look at what you've got. In each one of those pea seeds is a million more seeds. You know, if you think about how productive this is. And not only that, those peas are now adapted in some way naturally to where they grew. There are things that start to change plants every time they're planted. And we get to take part in that dance and help select them. So there's your peas. Here's a couple others, both wrinkle and smooth seeded peas. Those are two characteristics. And you can see, let them dry as much as you can before you harvest them. Lettuce, wow, isn't this great? One of the most popular other plants grown in gardens in America is also self-pollinating, which means you can grow two different kinds of lettuce in the same yard. Now, recommended not to grow them right next to each other, because there can be, as I said, there's always can be some cross-pollination, but by and large, these are self-pollinated flowers. You know, separate things with another flowering crop. Divide them as much as you can. You know, it's probably never a good idea for any of these crops to plant one right upwind and prevailing winds from the other one. You're just asking for, you know, you're tipping the odds in the favor that one of those grains of pollen is going to make it across to the other flower. So why do that? What makes lettuce so incredible to start collecting seeds from, I think, is that, you know, for almost my whole life, I would walk out into my garden inevitably in July. And I would be so disappointed, because even in one day, one hot day in July, my lettuce would bolt. That's our term for going to seed. It would start to rise up and get vertical. And all gardeners know that that means that the leaves start to get better, bitter. They have that white milk in them and they're changing. And so you just can't eat them as lettuce anymore. Now, instead of being disappointed, I'm excited, because now I'm starting on my seed saving adventure. I never save seeds from the first ones to bolt, because I don't want that characteristic. I don't want to pass that on. So I wait for later ones, because I want my lettuce to last longer in the garden. And so I'm selecting for lettuce that bolts later so that I can eat more of it before it does go to seed. And this is what it looks like. It goes up into yellow flowers. Those flowers turn into little white parachutes, and at the base of each parachute are the seeds. Sometimes they're kind of stuck together and they're hard to get apart. But, you know, when that happens for me at my home garden, again, it's easier on a small scale. I just plant the little 10 packs of seeds that are fused together and let them come up, and I thin them later. You know, and sometimes I don't get my lettuce seed totally clean. It's really hard to clean lettuce seed unless you use a fan and winnow it. But it works either way. And so what if you put a little bit of compost back in your garden with your seeds? You almost never get it to look like this. This was in a greenhouse that's perfectly still. Usually the wind starts to blow away some of the parachutes while there are even still yellow flowers on the plant. So I wait until the plants are about halfway turned to the white parachutes. And then if I need to, again, at the end of the season, I'll pull the whole plant, lay it on a tarp or hang it upside down until it finishes. And then I can shake off all the seeds. One of the big surprises to me after I garden for a long time is that four of our most popular grains are also self-pollinating plants, which means that we can start to grow those as beginners and start to learn to save and clean and eat these seeds. And again, I think the misunderstanding of scale that we're all bringing into this as modern creatures applies to even growing grains. I don't know how many times I've said to people that, you know, I'm starting to grow some of my own grains, and they immediately go to, wow, Bill, when did you buy acreage and a tractor? And no, you don't have to farm greens. You can garden them. And you can actually get enough oats or barley or wheat even out of a small 100 square foot plot to supplement your diet. You may not grow all you eat for a year, but you can begin to learn the crop and supplement it with ancient greens, einkorn and emmer and spelt. Many gardeners are doing this now because of their gluten intolerance, and they find the heritage grains are actually easier on them. And the other, I guess, surplus for this whole thing is that they're incredible dried flower arrangements before you actually thresh them and eat them. And so they even have a double use. You know, there's nothing like walking into a backyard and seeing amber waves of grain. There's just something satisfying about it. So barley, oats. Farmer John from Sustainable Seed Company has a cute little YouTube that shows you how to harvest your own backyard row of oats and thresh them and get them ready. And all you need is a little hand sickle or device to cut them into handfuls of oats and a trash can to bang them on to get the oats out. These are hullless oats. And he claims out of the row that he's in, he gets enough to feed himself breakfast for the whole year. So oats should definitely be on your list. Rice, if you live in a place that can grow rice, and you know, there are upland and cold tolerant varieties that can grow almost everywhere except for the higher elevations and the far north latitudes in the United States. The upland varieties grow in gardens. They don't need a rice paddy. And they're largely self-pollinating flowers, which makes them easy to start to save seeds and keep the different varieties separated. And of course, wheat. And this is what I'm starting to grow, and I'm so excited because there's so many. There may be 20,000 varieties of wheat out there. A huge diversity that's been created by our ancestors, just saving the seeds from where they are and changing it a little and adapting it to their own culture, their own ecology, their own needs. And now we get to dip back into that and on our own scale and in our own homes and figure out what we want to do. This is a black emmer that you see on the screen there. And so those are the nine sulfur vegetables that everybody should start saving seeds from. Even if you have hybrids growing, I would say, in your yard this year, even if you didn't plan on saving seeds, you could get started right away saving the seeds to the plants that you already have. Now, if you really want to impress yourself and your seed exchange and your seed library on your neighbors and get us all as a society down the road to building this resilient food system that's grounded in our own local seeds, then I just want to leave you with a few extra thoughts. Just remember that selection is the most powerful breeding technique for humans and plants. I honestly believe this. Biotech aside, we don't know where that's going or what they're doing or what kind of mistakes they may make. Because remember, agriculture's always been full of mistakes. And I'm always weary of people who say, oh, we're not going to make any mistakes. And I seem to be hearing this in the biotech industry way too much. And so just remember that all the food that we eat was created from wild plants. It was all done by small scale farmers and gardeners and amateurs, and they did it using selection as their only breeding technique. So there's Brassica oleraceae, and it was wild mustard, and it's been taken all over, especially Europe, to different cultures and different climates with different wants and needs, and look what came out of the one plant. It just shows you how malleable and how adaptable and how incredibly productive selection can be. This is a picture of stocky red rooster sweet peppers that Rowan White from Sierra Sea Co-op grew. She got the seed from Frank Morton from Wild Garden Seeds. And you'll notice this, especially if you're growing some of the older open pollinated or heritage varieties, is that some of them don't look as full or as healthy as the way you want them to. And so all the peppers on the left she harvested, and then the ones on the right of those shears are the ones she actually saved the seeds from. She was improving her variety, maintaining this open pollinated variety around an expectation that we have, that we want long and stocky peppers. Another thing she did was she was growing striped Romano tomatoes, and one year there was a plant that had yellow striped Romano tomatoes, and they were all yellow, and so she saved the seeds from those. She found a mutation, or a spore as we call it, and created a new variety, and you should always be on the lookout to do that. Selection can help us create new foods, and this has been happening since time immemorial. That's how we got so much of the diversity that we have. Selection pressures. Now, usually when people talk about that, they're talking about disease. But this could be drought. This could be flood. This could be a shade, if that's what is now covering your garden. Whatever it is, if you plant a bunch of something and only one or two of the plants or a few of them survive, that is not a disaster. Like this picture looks at UC Davis. You know, it looks like they lost their pepper crop to this pepper disease. No, what they've done is found a way to select for peppers that are resistant to that disease to go forward into the future. And so this is the mind shift that I think we all need to make, and you're forced to make it actually as a gardener, right? The oldest and the most experienced gardeners I know are always the most humble. Because there's just always unexpected disasters that happen to them. But the key is when you see that now, you realize that that's your seed-saving gold mine. That's what you want. You want a pepper that's resistant to the diseases. And so you may have to sacrifice a whole field. But if you find the one or two that are resistant, those are the ones that you save. That's selection. And of course, selection in dehybridizing vegetables. This is a picture of gypsy peppers. And so I saved the seeds, as I described before, from my F1 hybrid gypsies, and I planted them again. And instead of Mr. Toad's Wild Ride, which is what you would expect from a hybrid pepper, and I've, in experiments in the past using Ace F1 hybrid pepper, I planted out 200 plants in that second generation. I got everything from big white football looking peppers to little teeny red hot ones, and everything in between, every color of the rainbow. That's what I'm talking about when in that second generation, when diversity can express itself again from a hybrid. And so, but when I planted gypsy F2s, they were all the same. They looked like gypsies. And so what that told me was that it wasn't really a hybrid. That on some of the industries now are just calling their vegetables hybrids, even after they've stabilized the lines to make the seed production more simple and cheaper. But they put the F1 or the hybrid on the packet, to make us think that we can't save our own seeds. And so I just want to invite everyone to go on this adventure with me of dehybridizing. And I think you'll find the way I did that some of your favorite tomatoes and peppers are not hybrids anymore anyway. And that we're just being told that so that we won't save our own seeds. So I'm going to wrap up here. Just remember, all our food came originally from wild plants. And in the last 10 to 12,000 years, the only thing that bred it and made it better was the breeding technique called selection. All right? This is such a magical system, an abundant system. And it allows for such genetic changes that we have created this incredible food system. And in less than two generations, for most of it, we've lost most of that diversity. And now we get to be part of a generation that brings it back, that we finally learned that this industrial storm has been so great in some ways, but it has wreaked havoc on our food system and our diets. And that maybe the most important thing we can do is learn to save some of our own seeds. Because, you know, frankly, folks, in 1,000 years, farmers could look back at us at this era of the pinch, I called it, where we lose so much diversity because of our modern life, and then we start saving seeds and growing it back. Those farmers in 1,000 years looking back at us will go, wow, we needed that diversity to make our food system survive through all the changes that came about in the later 21st century. And those people that dropped everything, that saw through all the illusion and delusion of their day and got back down to this ritual of saving their own seeds and passing them on to the people, to their children and the people in their community, those people were really important people. We wouldn't have a food system without them. Just remember, farmers have been doing this for millennia. You can do it too. It can be easy. Start small. That makes it easier. Start with selfers. That makes it easier. And just remember this, if you remember nothing else from this webinar, that it is most appropriate biologically to steward seeds for diversity in a grassroots manner. There is no Calvary coming. There's nobody that's going to engineer our way out of this. There is no centralized agricultural or seed system that's going to do this, that's going to create this diversity. We have to do it. It has to be done on a grassroots level. It's just a biological fact. That's where we'll get more diversity. We get 1 million new seed savers, we're going to start producing millions of new varieties. So I hope you'll join me in this and start saving your selfers. And if we all do this together, maybe, just maybe, we'll save ourselves. Thank you.
Well, that was Bill McNorman, and didn't you love that presentation? I just really loved his explanation of how seed libraries work, to be honest with you. I haven't done much with seed libraries, and I know it's a growing trend around the United States, and I think it's awesome. It's starting to spread around the world. If you want to get in touch with Bill, and again, I would love to take his seed school. That looks just like an awesome training. Click the button on the right, the banner over there, and it'll take you to RockyMountainSeeds.org, which is Bill's organization. You get connected up there. I believe he'll have the free seed book for you to pick up, and then also information about his trainings and other places where he does appearances and speaking engagements. So that's Bill McNorman. This is Marjorie Wildcraft. We have over 35 presentations this year with the Mother Earth News Online Homesteading Summit, and I'll catch you in another one.